This audio recording is protected under U.S. copyright laws. It is produced by Nicholas Patrick CPE and provided by your State Society of CPAs for your personal non-commercial use. Further reproduction, distribution, or commercial use of this recording without written permission from Nicholas Patrick is prohibited. Requests for permission to reproduce this material should be addressed to Nicholas Patrick CPE, Suite A, 973 West Liberty Street, Hubbard, Ohio, 44425. Welcome to the Weekly Tax Update for January 20th, 2014. Last week, current developments provided a wide variety of topics, and we're going to talk about 10 of those in today's program. First, final rules on sales-based royalties and vendor allowances provide some relief from the proposed regulations, and you'll be interested to know what the differences are and what the final rules are. Then we have a piece on the expired extenders, and I want to talk a little bit about how that's going to affect financial reporting and the complications that will arise if, as, when, and if Congress decides to reinvigorate some of those laws or to pass some of the extenders or not. The Eighth Circuit has affirmed a surgeon's tax evasion and fraud convictions, which means he'll spend 60 months in the federal prison for participating in a scheme that involved a foreign employee leasing company and supposedly deferred compensation. Then a fairly common ruling in which the IRS waives the rollover requirement, the 60-day rollover requirement on an IRA, because an individual got bad advice. I want to remind us that it's always available. And then an electronic communication out of Chief Counsel's office and email in which the IRS explains that spouses who operate a qualified joint venture must each file a separate Schedule C, which will be attached to their jointly filed Federal Form 1040. Next, a topic we don't run into very often, a question of whether or not the IRS can penalize a taxpayer who does not file a Form 3520, which is an annual report return to report transactions with foreign trusts and receipt of certain foreign gifts. One interesting sidelight here is the statute has one threshold and the IRS has another compliance threshold. Then we have a ruling regarding captive insurance companies, which appears to be at odds with the 1989 decision. The tax court, depending on your point of view, has done a 180 in that with Humana back in 1989, the court said that a brother-sister relationship, that a captive insurance company, which was part of a controlled group, could not be an insurance company, and that payments to the captive were not deductible by its fellow group members. And in Rent-A-Center, Inc., the court in 142 TC number 1 has reached exactly the opposite conclusion, although not without some dissent. Next, we have disallowed expenses incurred by a couple who did not follow through on purported plans to develop the land around their home, some 80 acres in upstate New York. And finally, proposed regulations providing simple partnership loss transfer and basis reduction rules. The issue here is whether and how a partnership should account for the contribution of property by a partner when that property has a built-in loss. So there's a lot to talk about this week. Let's get started. Final regulations on sales-based royalties and vendor allowances can best be explained in two parts. The final regulations provide the allocation of sales-based royalties to property sold is optional rather than mandatory. The regs also clarify that sales-based royalties a taxpayer allocates entirely to inventory property sold are included in cost of goods sold and may not be included in determining the cost of goods on hand at the end of the tax year, regardless of the taxpayer's cost flow assumption. Then, as to vendor allowances, the final regulations provide that a vendor allowance does not reduce the cost of goods sold merely because the allowance is dependent on a sale of merchandise. According to the preamble to the final regs, the proposed regulations were overbroad because they required taxpayers to allocate to cost of goods sold all allowances that arise from selling merchandise. The final regulations specifically identify one type of sales-based vendor allowance, the sales-based vendor chargeback, that may reduce cost of goods sold and does not reduce the cost of goods on hand at the end of the tax year in order to clearly reflect income. Other sales-based vendor chargebacks could apply to goods sold and to goods on hand at year end. The regulations are pretty straightforward, only 10 pages, and it's a relatively easy read. Next, I want to talk a little bit about the confusion that is abroad in the land with regard to the so-called extenders. 55 federal tax provisions expired at the end of 2013. Another, let's see how many, that's 55. Another 8 at the end of 2016, 6 at the end of 2014, 5 at the end of 2017. And all of these tax provisions, all these code sections expiring, can, to the extent that they involve business taxes, be reflected in unusual adjustments in your financial statements. U.S. companies who will prepare their financial statements under GAAP are going to have to consider how the lapse of some of these tax provisions could affect their financial reporting and their tax provisions, in that if your provision anticipated that you would benefit from a credit, the question is, will the credit be available? Financial statement accounting rules also dictate that tax benefits have to be booked in the quarter they're received. A retroactive restatement of credits could result in a company reporting wildly gyrating earnings. For example, the January 2013 extension of the tax extenders last year resulted in calendar year companies reporting 5 periods of credits simultaneously, and that has the potential to really confuse investors and analysts. For those of you that are not fully informed about the federal tax provisions which are expiring and when, get a copy of JCX-1-14. That's a publication of the Joint Committee on Taxation and was issued on January the 10th, 2014. Next, Edward J.S. Picardi, M.D. Dr. Picardi was convicted in a jury trial of tax evasion, filing false returns, and failing to report his interest in foreign accounts to the IRS. This all had its genesis in his participation in an employee leasing scheme promoted by a CPA attorney whom he trusted. Dr. Picardi became a client of Anthony Crit in the mid-1990s. From 1997, sometime after Crit became his advisor, until 2003, Picardi participated in an employee leasing program promoted and run by Crit that required Picardi to enter a contract with Mountain Services Limited, an Irish corporation, to lease his services as a physician. Mountain Services contracted with professional leasing. That's not Mountain, Montrain. Montrain Services contracted with professional leasing services, a Nevada corporation that was operated by Crit, to provide Picardi services to professional leasing services. In turn, professional leasing services contracted with Picardi's medical group, and Picardi took a relatively small salary. Now, non-qualified deferred compensation works, and employee leasing works, but when you put them together in a plan that includes providing access to the supposedly deferred compensation through a complex web of foreign accounts and credit cards and loans and hidden transactions, then you've got the essence of the transactions for which Dr. Picardi was convicted. It is a wonderful example. Dr. Picardi had a good life. He apparently made a lot of money. He didn't see any reason why he should pay tax, and he was a sitting duck for a promoter like Crit. The lesson here, of course, is that all that glitters is not gold. If it seems too good to be true, it probably isn't. And there are very few things that the IRS and Congress have in fact missed that provide big opportunities for tax savings. Next, letter ruling 2014-02-018, in which the IRS waives the 60-day rollover requirement for a distribution from an IRA. Fairly straightforward facts. Taxpayer represents he received a distribution. His failure to comply was due to incorrect advice provided by his financial advisor. Taxpayer had an annuity contract. He had other retirement savings with the company. Because of the bad advice, the money went into the wrong account. Here's the conclusion of the IRS's favorable ruling. The information presented and documentation submitted by taxpayer A is consistent with his assertion that his failure to accomplish a timely rollover was due to incorrect advice provided by individual B, the financial advisor. And I will tell you, based on what I've seen in other rulings, the only way the taxpayer A got that ruling was some of his evidence submitted was an affidavit from individual B that he had in fact given the bad advice. Next up, an electronic communication and email coming out of the chief counsel's office concluding that spouses who operate a qualified joint venture as that is defined in the Small Business and Work Opportunity Act of 2007, must each file a separate Schedule C, which will then be attached to their jointly filed Form 1040. In response to a question from the examining agent, the correspondent for the Chief Counsel's Office says, "I agree. The business income should have been reported on a Schedule C. You ask whether a Schedule C can be jointly operated. The answer is an unincorporated business jointly owned by a married couple is generally classified as a partnership for federal tax purposes. However, for tax years beginning after December 31st, 2006, the Small Business and Work Opportunity Act of 2007 provides that a qualified joint venture whose only members are a husband and wife filing a joint return can elect not to be treated as a partnership for federal tax purposes. Both spouses still get Social Security credit if they elect for the business to be treated as a qualified joint venture." And here's the reason that you would want to elect to treat a family business as a qualified joint venture. That's so that each spouse gets Social Security credit without the burden of one spouse having to treat the other spouse as an employee and put them on the payroll. Next, another Chief Counsel email in which the IRS concludes that when a U.S. taxpayer who receives a reportable gift from a foreign person fails to file the necessary Form 3520, annual return to report transactions with foreign trusts and receipt of certain foreign gifts, the IRS may impose a penalty of 5% per month up to a 25% maximum on the gross value of the gift. And by the way, this is one of those interesting areas in the tax law where the IRS has chosen not to enforce the law at the level in the statute. The statute says you got to report gifts in excess of $10,000. The IRS has adopted an administrative rule that you're only required to report gifts in excess of $100,000 from the same individual or related individuals or related persons, I should say, is probably more accurate. Next, Rent-A-Center is allowed to deduct premiums paid to a wholly owned insurance company. This is a divided tax court. Judge Foley writes for the majority, and seven agree with him. We have one dissent in which four other judges agree. So you got five dissents. Then you've got a concurring opinion that kind of comes at the question from a different angle, and four individuals concur with the judge who wrote that opinion. So you've got 12 who either agree with Judge Foley's decision or they agree with the concurring opinion. One judge did not participate. The situation is fairly straightforward. Rent-A-Center, Inc. has several subsidiaries. One of those subsidiaries is a wholly owned insurance company. The other subsidiaries pay premiums to the wholly owned insurance company, and the wholly owned insurance company is headquartered in Bermuda. It is subject to the regulation of the Bermuda tax authorities. It operates as an insurance company. The majority opinion, here's a quote from the majority opinion, "The policies at issue shifted risk from Rent-A-Center Inc.'s insured subsidiaries to Legacy, which was the name of the insurance company, which was formed for a valid business purpose, which was a separate, independent, and viable entity, was financially capable of meeting its obligations, and did in fact reimburse Rent-A-Center Inc.'s subsidiaries when they suffered an insurable loss. The court also went on to rule that the risk was adequately distributed and conclude that the payments by the operating subsidiaries to the insurance subsidiaries were deductible by the operating subsidiaries as insurance payments under Section 162. Now, it really gets interesting because the insurance company receives the insurance premiums, and it does not report all of the premium revenue as income because it is entitled to establish reserves. Judge Halpern dissented from the majority opinion, and he called the court's attention to the fact that they had in Humana back in 1987 held that a captive insurance arrangement between brother-sister corporations could not be insurance as a matter of law. So it's a 25-page opinion. There's 25 pages of opinion. It's not all one opinion. The judge has really weighed in on this one. And the reason is this has been a hot issue for a long time. And for a long time, the IRS really took the position that premiums paid to a captive insurance company could not, as a matter of law, be deductible by the entities that paid the premiums. And so this decision turns that approach on its head. It's well worth reading for anyone who is dealing with a client where you have a consolidated group or a control group, and one member of the control group is an insurance company receiving premiums from other members of the group. Next, Albert Chin, TC Summary Opinion 2014-6. The tax court here upholds an IRS determination and an accuracy-related penalty, finding that a couple was not entitled to deduct expenses supposedly related to planning the development of real estate that they never sold. They had not, by the way, completely abandoned the development, so there was no abandonment loss, and they didn't show why they shouldn't be subject to the penalty. The planning for the development of this 88.81-acre parcel on which the taxpayer's residence was situated, it was the only residence on the 88 acres, the planning for development started back in 2003, and 6 years later, in 2009, there had not been any sales, but there were deductions every year for expenses paid to consultants and for fees paid to the planning commission. It's probably worth noting that Albert Chin, the husband, is a retired civil engineer, and Nai Fin Chin, the wife, is a retired registered nurse. He was retired before 2009, but performed work for several companies on a consulting basis. She retired around 2003, about the time they decided they were going to develop this property, entered the real estate business around 2007, became a licensed real estate agent, and her commission income was never very much, about $800 a year for the 2 years that she actually received commissions. So it appears that we've got a couple of folks here that have other income, no particular abiding ambition to develop the property. Maybe just maybe we will, maybe we won't. Let's see. But that doesn't rise to the level of a trade or business of developing property, which would allow them to deduct the expenses. Finally, we have proposed regulations that provide simple, hopefully, partnership loss transfer and basis reduction rules where a partner transfers property to a partnership and the property has a built-in loss. That is, its basis is greater than its fair market value. Code Section 704C1C is the code section to which these regulations relate, and Congress, of course, enacted that particular provision to prevent loss duplication. Under Section 704C1C, the built-in loss in the contributed property can be taken into account only by the contributing partner. These proposed regulations provide rules on 1. The scope of Section 704C1C, 2. The effect of any built-in loss, 3. Distributions by partnerships holding Section 704C1C property, that is, property with a built-in loss, 4. Transfers of a partnership interest at a time when the partnership interest is the subject of a Section 704C1C adjustment, transfers of Section 704C1C property, and finally, the related reporting requirements. Section 743 is incorporated into these regulations by reference, and of course Section 743 requires a partnership to adjust the basis of partnership property upon a sale or exchange of a partnership interest or death of a partner if there is a Section 754 election in effect, or for transfers after October 22, 2004, if the partnership has a substantial built-in loss immediately after the transfer, regardless of whether a Section 754 election is in effect. Section 743E was added to provide alternative rules for electing investment partnerships, so-called EIPs, and Section 743F was added to provide an exception from the mandatory basis adjustment provisions for securitization partnerships. These proposed regulations clarify that if a partnership has a substantial built-in loss immediately after the transfer of a partnership interest, the partnership is treated as having a Section 754 election in effect for the tax year in which the transfer occurs, but only for that transfer. The regulations also provide that in determining whether there is a substantial built-in loss, Section 743B adjustments and 704C1C basis adjustments are generally disregarded. Then there are special rules for determining fair market value and basis adjustments in the case of a tiered partnership. With regard to electing investment partnerships, the regulations generally adopt the statutory language in Section 743E. They don't just reference it, they adopt it in whole part, and the provisions of Notice 2005-32. However, there is clarification that the reporting requirements for transferors of an interest in an electing investment partnership, which are described in the notice, do not apply if the transferor recognizes gain on the transfer, and no prior transferor recognized a loss on any transfer. The proposed regulations also generally follow the statutory provisions regarding substantial basis reduction under Section 734, because the same issues that exist in the context of 743B adjustments and tiered partnerships also exist regarding Section 734B adjustments and tiered partnerships. So you got similar guidance for substantial basis reductions in tiered partnership arrangements. The regulations continue to restate the statutory provisions of Section 755C and provide rules applicable to an allocation of a downward adjustment in the basis of partnership property under Section 734B and 755A, providing that in making an allocation under Section 755 of any decrease in the adjusted basis of partnership property under Section 734, no allocation may be made to stock in a corporation or any person related to the corporation that is a partner in the partnership. Now, what that means is, I read that, you probably tell that I was reading it, what that means is that if you're allocating a built-in loss among a number of items of property, you're going to apply the same rules that you would apply in allocating basis for purposes of Section 755 when you have a 734 or 743 adjustment pursuant to a 754 election. And I know that kind of sounds complicated, but those of you that deal with it, I know exactly what I'm talking about. And those of you that don't are going to be confused no matter what happens here. There's also a provision that built-in gain and built-in loss do not take into account any decreases or increases to the property's book value if that is revalued in connection with a revaluation of partnership property. So the guidance is comprehensive, 47 pages in these regulations, but the guidance was sorely needed in order to implement a code section that Congress passed back in 2004. So we've been waiting a while for the regulations. We finally got them. And that's a wrap for this week. As always, we admonish you, stay safe.